From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new report questions the T's culture of safety. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak gives us his response.
The T has always said that safety is our top priority.
Also today, our week in review. Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev is on death row. This week, his attorneys appealed his sentence.
This case should not have been tried in Boston. The marathon bombings targeted a beloved and iconic civic institution. They traumatized an entire community.
The government says Tsarnaev was given a fair trial.
A majority of prospective jurors indicated that they could keep an open mind, both with respect to Mr. Tsarnaev's guilt and the appropriate penalty.
We'll ask our panelists what they think and hear from former federal judge Nancy Gertner. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new report questions the T's culture of safety. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak gives us his response.
The T has always said that safety is our top priority.
Also today, our week in review. Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev is on death row. This week, his attorneys appealed his sentence.
This case should not have been tried in Boston. The marathon bombings targeted a beloved and iconic civic institution. They traumatized an entire community.
The government says Tsarnaev was given a fair trial.
A majority of prospective jurors indicated that they could keep an open mind, both with respect to Mr. Tsarnaev's guilt and the appropriate penalty.
We'll ask our panelists what they think and hear from former federal judge Nancy Gertner. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. An MBTA safety review panel report came out earlier this week, and it ultimately found that the T's approach to safety was questionable. One panel member, former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, put it this way.
We found that the T is safe. They've made some very good improvements, but the T can be safer.
Well, we spoke with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. He told us safety's always been a priority at the MBTA.
The T has always said that safety is our top priority. I think what this report tells us is some of the resources, we are not giving enough resources to safety, and that some of the processes and procedures are not right, and we need to get oriented around that. The capital acceleration work, much of which is focused on modernizing the system, does provide an important contribution to safety, but it also stretches some of our resources really thin. And we need to do a better job of making sure we have enough resources to do the preventive maintenance, kind of the emergency maintenance work, and the capital appreciation. And we're doing that with this Flex Force funding, which we got $32 million for last night, thanks to the legislature for that funding, which is going to allow us to have enough resource to do all three of those things.
So I want to stop and ask you about that, because the governor had asked for $50 million, and then you got 32. So you're saying 32 is enough. And I mean, I'm not saying you're saying you didn't need $50 million, because, of course, everybody wants more money for their budgets. But you're saying 32 is enough. You're satisfied with that $32 million number.
The $32 million gives us the opportunity to get started. And we've started. We've hired over 100 people who are going to work on this Flex Force, which is going to allow us to do more preventive maintenance and allow us to do capital acceleration. We're going to, over time, and this is consistent with one of the recommendations in the report, make sure we think we've hired enough people so that we can cover all the preventive maintenance and do the capital appreciation. However, as part of the FY21 budget process, if we feel like we don't have enough people, we will address that. We will fund those positions to make sure that we can do everything we want to do in terms of safety and the capital acceleration work.
How do you think, Steve, as the newest of, the report says, a line of 9 general managers since 2010, how do you personally think about, okay, we got to improve the safety culture and the safety practices inside the T, so my top priorities are ABC?
Sure. I think of it in a couple different ways. I think there's the things that we're sort of objectively moving to do. We are going to add staffing in the safety department. We are going to develop best-in-class key performance indicators and track them over time to make sure we're tracking the right things on safety and make sure we're making progress. And then I think there's a whole area of more subjective work, which is improving the safety culture at the T. And that starts with me, and it starts with the whole organization understanding that everyone there is responsible for safety, and that when they bring a safety issue either to my attention or to some member of the management team's attention, that something will be done.
What are the biggest pain points from your perspective for the T right now?
I think for us it is making sure that we're always prioritizing and that we're prioritizing safety. And I think this report goes a long way towards allowing us to do that. I think everyone is focused on safety, and we will continue to be. And that is, you know, my personal pledge that we will continue to focus on safety. I think one of our other issues is sort of bandwidth in terms of not only having enough time to do all the things we want to do, but also getting the employees.
If I were tweeting at you, I would be like, Steve Poftek, the Orange Line, what the heck? So let's just start there. Steve, the Orange Line, what the heck?
Sure. Couple issues here. One, we had a period of you know, very subpar performance last week where we had a bunch of in-service failures. And we tracked that very closely.
So for listeners, yep. What does that mean?
That means a train set that is running, stops running, and then everyone's offloaded onto the platform. They have to move the train set out of the station, and then you have to wait for the next train, which in some cases we're looking at headways of 12 to 20 minutes, which is obviously very disruptive.
And it was during bad weather.
During bad weather, during rush hour. So that's something we're taking a look at. Why are those in-service failures happening? Right now, kind of in aggregate, we're not seeing an increase overall. But when you have three during a rush hour, it's incredibly disruptive.
Yeah, and why that's something we want to look at. Why does it feel like an increase to riders? So you're saying that if you average this out over time, we're not seeing more incidents on the Orange Line in general. But it seems like a lot, especially since October when you had to take the new
Not right now. And that's something we'll take a look at, and okay. If it is an increase. But, you know, sort of over the last few months, there hasn't been any kind of noticeable decay in these in-service failures. I think the second part of your question probably has to do with the new cars.
Okay.
Where are the new cars? The new cars were taken out of service on November 18th because we were getting a noise that was coming from pads that are in the truck, essentially the wheel assembly and how it interfaces with the vehicle. There's an issue with those pads. We're working on a fix for that. There will be a fix forthcoming. I can't give a date certain. From my point of view, my priority is always going to be safety and the long life of those vehicles. We're going to get 404 of these cars for the Orange and Red Line. To the extent that we catch problems like this early in the production process, we can then fix it for all 404 cars. So it is frustrating. I would love to have the new cars out there, but the important thing is these 404 cars are going to last at least 30 years. We want to make sure we catch problems early. I'm really excited to get them back out there and to get additional cars back out there, but I won't do it until I'm satisfied that we've fixed the problem and that we've fixed the problem going forward in the production process.
In sort of simple lay people's terms, what money is supposed to be coming from what kinds of sources over the next couple of years? And do you have the right amount of money in each of the types of money that you need? So money for day-to-day versus money to buy new things versus money to work on safety. Where is it coming from? What's supposed to be coming? And do you have the right stuff in the right places?
I believe we do right now. We have we have over $9 billion available to us to spend on capital over the next 5 years.
And when you say capital, specifically, what do you mean?
It is things other than operating. So
Okay. Building...
You know, building new stations, buying new cars, putting in track, that type of work. We have that's a mixture of state funds and federal funds and some of the T's own bond money. Our challenge on the capital side really is, can we spend that amount of money? First of all, because we are very aggressively building an organization that can kind of project manage that level of spending. And the other thing, as we're seeing, is it's disruptive. We're going from
more about that.
In FY11, the T spent $400 million. In FY19, the T spent $1 billion.
Okay.
In FY20, we believe we will spend something close to $1.4 billion. So we're essentially taking the amount of money we spent in FY11, and that's going to be the difference between FY19 and FY20. That is just such a significantly higher level of activity that in order to do it, we have to do things like we've done diversion work on the core of the system, on the Orange Line and the Red Line over the fall.
So that's when people get on shuttle buses rather than on the train tracks because you've got to be on the tracks.
Because we've got to be on the tracks. And we know it's inconvenient. We appreciate our customers' patience, but we're also able to get a lot more work done and really pull in projects that would have taken on an overnight, you know, that potentially would have taken another 12 months to do, we were able to do in just a number of weekends. I think on the capital side, our challenge is a logistical one. How can we get all this work done and how can we get it done in the period of time? On the operating side, the T has the money it needs to operate the system as it is now. There's a number of things sort of coming down the road in the longer term. There's a very aggressive commuter rail vision idea that there's going to be a longer term funding conversation around that. So I think there's a conversation to be had down the road, but we have the revenue we need to run the system as it is now in the FY20 budget cycle. We're just in the process of developing the FY21 budget, and that's something we'll reexamine.
We've seen estimates from various sources that suggest that to ease transportation, which is bad in Greater Boston, the MBTA over time would need closer to $50 billion. The reason I ask this is we heard Bob DeLeo earlier this week after the safety report say, we got to talk about new revenues. We got to talk about new revenues. Then when there was the supplemental spending bill yesterday, the ask was for $50 million for the T and you got $32 million. You're saying that in the short term, you have enough money and that the $9 billion is challenging actually to spend that much. There's a disconnect in the public discussion in those things. Explain that.
Well, I think that, you know, I think the $50 billion is part of a longer term vision, which, you know, my expectation is, you know, potentially has a 5, 10, 15, 20 year life to it. And it also contains a number of items. I mean, it's the option that gets you closer to that number contains a number of things that I don't think are necessarily going to, you know, all going to happen at once. So what I'm really looking at is we've got a couple major expansion projects in the pipeline, right? We're going to do South Coast Rail. We're going to do Green Line Extension. And we are also committed to addressing the maintenance backlog. We're committed to addressing the capital needs of the T, which is going to take us until 2032. Right now, we have a fully funded capital budget for the next 5 years, and that's where the $9 billion number comes from.
Okay. It's cold. We've had our first storm. There have been some troubles on the red, the green, and the orange line in the last couple of weeks. The report on Monday says both the T is safe and there's a safety culture problem at the T. What do you want to tell listeners who are like, am I safe? Is the train going to be there for me tomorrow? Do you have what you need? And if not, what do we need to give you? And do you understand that this is hard for me? What do you say?
You know, I want to express my appreciation to all our customers. I want to assure them that the MBTA is safe. I take the MBTA every day. Members of my family take the MBTA every day. That said, this report has some very sobering conclusions, and we are committed as an organization to addressing them. We are putting the resources in place to address them. It is not a resource issue. And we are also committed to addressing in improving the safety culture here at the MBTA. That is not a trivial task, but I believe in this workforce. I'm proud to be their colleague, and it's something that I know we can do.
That was Steve Poftek, MBTA General Manager. Stay with us. Coming up, our Week in Review this week will focus on Jahar Tsarnaev's appeal. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev received the death penalty. Yesterday, our lawyers argued he shouldn't have. WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner was there at the appeal. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and with us today to give us some analysis on that. Welcome back, Judge Gertner.
Good to be here, as always.
I want to kind of start by acknowledging that this is a painful subject for our community. There's probably no one listening who wasn't affected, and it is jarring, I think, to be back having this conversation again. Why are we?
Because there was an appeal, because there were issues that were raised about jury selection, about how the trial could take place in Boston and whether that was appropriate, given the fact that, as the defendant said, Boston was the victim here. This isn't just an ordinary crime. This was a crime at an iconic event. And so these issues were preserved by the lawyers to argue on appeal. And it's not unusual in any case that there be appeals. And in a case involving the death penalty, one can expect every procedural route will be addressed, because that's what the lawyers are supposed to do when death hangs in the balance.
So you just ticked off two of the three basic claims made yesterday, the third one being that there was reason to believe that Tsarnaev's older brother, who died a few days after the bombing was killed, had committed a murder, but was never prosecuted for it.
Right.
So if those are the three principles of the appeal, and that ought to have been included in the case, are they right? Are there traction on any of those three?
Well, let me start with the jury selection issue. So two jurors, one juror in particular, one juror was told, for example, that she was asked whether or not she read or saw anything about the case, including online. And she hid from the judge that she had herself posted 22 Twitter entries in which she talked about Tsarnaev as a piece of garbage, talked about the victims, talked about the police involved. So there are two things about that. I mean, one is she didn't raise that with the judge at all. And when asked if she had been online or talked about the case to anyone, she falsely denied it.
Did the judge never know that, Judge O'Toole, who oversaw the original case?
With respect to this juror, he learned of it while she was still, before she had been finally selected. And rather than doing what judges would typically do, which is to bring her in and say, did you do these 22 Twitter posts? It was clear that she did, and ask why and whether or not this could have been an inadvertent error. He never followed through, and that's an error.
So Judge Gertner,
but then there was the second juror who's told, do not go online, do not join Facebook groups. And while he was in the middle of jury selection, he actually put together a Facebook group
during selection
in which the other people in the group were telling him how to essentially fake it to get on the jury. So he lied about that contact, disobeyed the judge's instructions, and it was prejudicial.
So there is one of the appeals court's judges. This is William Cayatta, yesterday suggesting maybe that this was a mistake on Judge O'Toole's part.
Why wouldn't a judge want to know how that juror explains that difference? They forgot it, or wouldn't we at least ask the juror?
So Cayatta says that. Does that make you think that possibly the appeals court's going to think there's traction there?
You never know. You see this in Supreme Court arguments all the time. Sometimes the questions that a judge asks during the course of an argument, don't really predict what they're going to do. But it is significant that they ask the questions raised in the defendant's brief. That suggests that they think that there is some traction to that. But it was not only that. There was also not just the juror selection issue. When I was on the bench, if a juror lied during jury selection, that's really a big deal.
So because, this is a big deal.
Yeah, because the only way you will know the only way you can select a fair juror is if people answer the questions truthfully. And to not answer the questions truthfully, or in the case of the other juror, to disobey a judge's instructions doesn't bode well for the kind of juror that they would be.
Now, this seems tied to the other big argument, which was shouldn't have done it in Boston, too close to home, you can't get a fair trial. On the one hand, you hear that these jurors were tweeting about it and had a Facebook page, and you think, okay, I get that. On the other hand, in the era of social media, everybody knows about a crime of this size. So how far away would you have to go to impanel a jury that can do it and is not going to have been influenced by an event of this magnitude?
That's a really great question. But the issue here is not only who heard about the case. I mean, that happens if there's a highly publicized murder, like in O.J. Simpson in California. How many people knew about the O.J. Simpson case? This was about, part of their argument was that Boston was the victim. This is now a situation in which this was intended to terrorize a city, and it terrorized a city. Everyone, the argument went, was affected by this. Either you were locked down in the areas where they were searching for the defendants, or you were affected in some way by the calls for money. And everyone was affected. So Boston was the victim, not so much that everyone heard about the case, which makes this a unique kind of argument.
I want to just grab a piece of sound. This is Appeal Court Judge Juan Torreya to that point.
Now, one of the things about terrorism, leaving the facts in this case, is it impacts a community. It's the whole point of terrorism.
So he's saying the whole point is to victimize the whole community.
Right, right.
At some point, do you have to be able to rely on individual citizens in a community to be willing to be impartial and participate in the legal process that way? Or does it just sort of de facto negate entire communities who may have the horrible experience of something like this happening?
It doesn't de facto, but certainly it matters that Boston was affected as a victim in this way. I can't emphasize this enough, which is that it's not just a lot of people heard about this case and it's a high profile case. It is uniquely that Boston was the victim. And the two arguments, the arguments about jury selection on the one hand and change of venue on the other, are tied in the following way, which is essentially what they were saying is, if you were to have it in Boston, it makes it all the more critical that this be a careful jury selection. It makes it particularly serious.
So one quick last question. With that note that all of Boston was the victim, if this is reversed, the judge, the prosecution, should they, will they be held accountable in some way for having mispracticed in the original prosecution?
No, no one is held accountable for essentially a legal judgment. What will happen is that the case will likely go to a different judge if it's reversed, and that judge would then have to make the decision about whether in 2020 the situation is the same as it was when this case was tried and whether it's fair to have the case in Boston.
Okay, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, stay with us. More ahead, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We have a foreshortened week in review for you this week, and we're choosing to focus on the appeal this week by Jahar Tsarnaev, who received the death penalty after the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. Just before the break, our WBUR legal analyst, Judge Nancy Gertner, who was at the appeal yesterday, told us about the arguments. She's still with us, and now I want to bring in our week in review panelists. We have Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we have Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good. Glad to be here.
So, Jennifer and Michael, what are your reactions to the arguments you heard yesterday, both as people who were here at the time of the bombing and as people who are analyzing what you heard?
I do think in the final analysis that the defendant did get a fair jury and a fair trial, right? And that's the real ultimate question. And the reason I think we know that, despite the fact that it was held in Boston and despite the fact that certain jurors may have tweeted about the case or posted things on social media, is that in the last analysis, they didn't give him the death penalty on 11 of the 17 charges. Right. So if this had been an emotional, reactive jury, they would have given him the death penalty on all of them. But they didn't. They gave him the death penalty on six of the charges, which tells me, as an analyst, as a legal analyst and as an observer, that they methodically went through the evidence as a group and determined that in the majority of cases, of the majority of charges, the government did not prove their case and they did not give him the death penalty. And where the government did prove their case, they did. And so that shows me they were able to be neutral.
Michael, you're nodding.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. One, thank God for our Constitution and how our process plays out, that people have an appeal. And, you know, as a person who was going down to the Boston Marathon that day, was really stuck in traffic, was not there when it happened, there's a personal connection to this story. Putting that aside, understanding that no matter how heinous the crime is, he has a right to appeal his case. And I think, as the judge pointed out, there were some legitimate issues that came up during this trial. the jurors and their tweets, the social media piece. We're just talking off air about this age of social media. It's a slippery slope there when you start in retrospect looking at back at what people said online and what they did. I would argue, like we just had a recent survey that says some large percentage of people lie to their doctors. I would argue that many people lie to their judges when you're sitting there and they say, well, let me tell
not
you.
Not to me.
Never to you.
If they say, have you heard this? Have you talked about it before? You can't verify if I'm telling the truth or not. But now with the age of social media, if I've communicated with somebody in the public space, now someone can go back and check that. That may open up a Pandora's box with a lot of these cases where jurors have not been honest. So I think there's a slippery slope there.
Well, that's interesting. So you're saying that this could actually, other defense attorneys could go back and start looking.
Absolutely. About whether there was a truthfulness of the jurors when they were prospective.
No, but what was different in this case is that the defendants knew about the lie while the juror was in the box. That is to say, the judge could well, and there were other jurors waiting to be selected. So he had a means of fixing this by either asking the jurors more questions or going to someone as to whom there wasn't that issue.
Absolutely.
So how did you react to that, Jennifer, given your opening comments on this?
I don't know, because I wasn't there, and I think that voir dire is very fact-specific, and it's very, you know, unless I read the juror's survey or you know, was there when Judge O'Toole made that decision, I hesitate to criticize it. I will say that in the final analysis, though, I think that based on their ruling, it is clear that he got a fair verdict and an impartial jury in the end. And with respect to the question of venue, I have to respectfully disagree about, you know, this whole notion that Boston itself was the victim. I do understand that that's the goal of terrorism, but in effect, the entire country is the victim of a terrorist act. Right? Terrorists commit, they're not just going after Boston or New York. They're going after the American ideal. And so if the whole country is the victim, are we really saying that they can't get a fair trial anywhere in the nation?
So what are we saying? This is an interesting question, Michael. Yeah. When an act of terror is meant to terrorize, and especially where an information flows so freely that people know they are being terrorized, even if they weren't in the vicinity, how do you think about something like an impartial jury?
Yeah, I mean, and the judge would be have direct knowledge on how those things are factored. And I think just from folks who are watching this, it is going to be very difficult in this day and age for anyone not to know what's happening when it's a leading story. I talk to folks in New York and in Chicago who feel just as impacted as Bostonians because they had marathon runners in that race that day. They're coming here. Even to this day, people come to visit. They say, Mike, can we go down to the Boston Marathon bombing? Because they feel personally connected. The reality is for the judge in this case to figure out whether that person can get a fair trial. That's a deeper conversation that I think is sort of trivialized by this notion that we're all victims as a city. In fact, the fair trial, I would agree that I think a fair trial was had here. Now, whether there were some errors, I think it is yet to be determined.
So, but you can't
ahead,
judge the fairness of a trial by the verdict in this respect. We've now had, 40 years of wrongful convictions where jurors listening to the evidence said it was fine. So the fact of the verdict is not the answer. The fact
but
of
there's
the
no,
process.
There's no wrongful conviction here. I mean,
but the issue is the process. All we can do is look at the process.
The issue
and
is
say
whether
if the process was flawed, then you reverse
the
it.
The issue is whether there was bias that affected the decision of the jury. The issue is not whether or not these people had heard about it, whether or not they were impacted by it, or even whether they had an opinion. The issue is whether they could put those things aside and deliberate fairly.
Right, and if they're not telling you the truth, then how do you know that they can put it aside?
Well,
let me finish. I think they could put it aside for the reason I said at the beginning, because they didn't give him the death penalty on the majority of counts. Let's start with that. But I also think that, you know, the woman posted something about, you know, oh, he's garbage or whatever. That really wasn't the issue, because the trial opened, let's remember, with his defense attorney saying he did it. Okay? This was never, he didn't plead guilty.
But in their opening statement.
But the defense strategy at trial was to say, yes, he did do it, but he shouldn't be held responsible right. because he was under the influence of his older brother.
By his older
so
brother.
Whether or not you believe that he is quote-unquote garbage doesn't impact that analysis. It really doesn't. You could think somebody's garbage,
but
that they were influenced by their older brother, or you could think they were garbage and they weren't influenced
by their
older brother.
No, but the issue is telling the truth. I mean, here, I instructed juries all the time, and I question juries all the time, and the system requires that they be telling the truth to you, both in terms of following my directions and in terms of the jury selection. So when you have jurors that are not telling the truth to the judge under oath at that very preliminary stage, that's a very troublesome thing, and that casts doubt on the fairness of the process.
I agree that it's problematic, and obviously one should never lie to a judge.
You think so?
No, I think it's problematic, but that's not really the question. The question is, did having that person on the jury influence the outcome in a way that made it?
But actually, the legal question is, with respect to juror errors, they're considered, as a matter of law, as structural errors. In other words, you don't ask, was the rest of the trial fair? If the jury selection was impaired, that's a structural error.
But I don't
error.
Think
okay,
the jury selection
stop us
was
on this
impaired.
Now. Sorry. No, it's okay. I think that's great. And I think it's great for people to be able to hear that discussion. But I'm mindful of time, and there is a different piece of this conversation that I also want to bring in. So I'm going to really shift gears for us now. I've been thinking about this. I want to acknowledge 264 people wounded, 3 people died from the bombing, a police officer was killed, an MIT police officer was killed a few days later, according to the Boston police. A few years later, another police officer ultimately died from his injuries. At the time, I mean, I was here in this studio sitting in your chair to cover the live coverage of the verdict the day it came out. And even then, the pain was so raw. It was so complete for our community. We're able now, and Judge Gertner pointed this out to me on a break, we're able now to have a different kind of conversation. We're having an analytic conversation we would not have been able to have at that time.
Right.
Were this to somehow be reversed, and we have some kind of new trial, and I don't even fully understand what that would be, what does that do to us as a community? What does it do to us to bring this all back out again? Michael, I want to start with you.
Well, I don't know what it does to us as a community. I think, you know, many of us have continued to have these conversations because we've seen other incidents across the country. So this has become a normal to have these sort of heinous hate crimes happening. And some of us are immersed in sort of even the right side of seeing what this looks like when people attack certain communities. So I think it reminds us that we have to have two conversations. One is about the trauma it causes, and we're still sorting through that trauma. And then two, the procedural issues. He is appealing his case. We should appreciate that our system allows people to make the arguments they need to make, that maybe death sentence wasn't the appropriate for him. I'm not saying that I believe that, but that the system allows him to argue that.
So that brings up another interesting question, and I will bring this to both of the lawyers in the room. Part of what we're going through now, we're experiencing because there was a choice at the federal level to pursue the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Gertner, let me just ask you to react to that.
Well, there was controversy about whether to do that, but it raises questions just as a prediction now. So if everything is reversed, then there could well be a plea to life that was in fact not on the table initially. So it may well be
this Justice Department will not take a plea to life.
Okay.
I'm quite certain of that.
Well, that is interesting, because right? Because we're doing this now.
Yeah, because the question is...
The Obama Justice Department didn't take it, and this Justice Department
won't.
Certainly
I suppose,
will not
I suppose.
Take
I mean,
it.
I suppose, but the argument would be that if you want to spare the community, the pain of going through another trial, that's the way to do it. And that was part of the argument at the beginning.
But is it about getting justice for the community, or is it about making sure that this person gets what he deserves?
So let me ask another question, too, on this, which is we actually are also in a moment where at the federal level, death penalty, carrying out the death penalty has been suspended. Does that figure into this is a genuine question, not rhetorical. Does that figure into this picture in any way, legally, politically, et cetera.
Well, part of the debate at the beginning, and I was part of that debate, is will this guy ever get the death penalty? Will that ever be executed, the death penalty executed, literally?
Will it actually happen?
Will it actually happen, right, given the fact that he's entitled to every appeal, given the difficulties with the federal death penalty, given to the fact that, in fact, there hadn't been an execution, I believe, since McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh.
Right, Timothy McVeigh from the Oklahoma City bombing case. So if that's true, then we have all aligned with an outcome that isn't likely to happen in anyone in the near term, and therefore is it better to do life imprisonment?
Michael Curry, have we had enough closure?
I don't think we have enough, clearly, procedurally, have enough closure because he's appealing. But I think there is a continued conversation that needs to be had about our trial process. I do believe there's a lot there in terms of social media and what it introduces to us about looking back in retrospect at the comments that people make. Again, I do believe people lie to judges, and I'll call them little white lies when they say, well, I didn't know anything. I didn't see anything. And they go into it thinking, well, I can still be impartial, that I can still be a juror, but I'm not going to be as honest about every thing I may have seen or read. So I think that's part of it. So yes, yes, absolutely.
All right. I'm going to have to stop us there, although I'd like to keep going. Michael Curry, that was Michael Curry, the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board. Thank you. Also with us, Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And WBUR legal analyst, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hey, join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.